Can we go ahead then? Who am I, you mean? You don't know who I am, you shouldn't be in this. Sorry. Now, I'm Lewis Wolpert, and I'm a developmental biologist, and I was one of the for this particular week, Sean Carroll and I were largely involved in organizing this, and Sean, unfortunately, is unable to come, and he sends his apologies, and it's a really, really bad that he can't come, but he really can't. And so we've got about 45 minutes before we break for coffee. I think it's just worth reminding you that this is really about bringing physicists and biologists. Can you hear me all right? By bringing physicists and biologists together. And the biologists, when they give their talks, are just going to have to tolerate the physicists interrupting them within limits. And I will try to chair some of it and keep it under control. But there's no point, you know, if a biologist uses a word like decapentaplegic and you've never heard it before, they're perfectly entitled to say, oh, what on earth are you talking about, or to explain this, because otherwise you just sit there getting lost. So it's a different sort of meeting. And what I'm going to do, and now I'm so sophisticated I even know how to turn on the... You see, being in a physics place now, gosh. Oh, well. That's okay. What do you mean, that's okay? Oh, my machine's gone to sleep in the meantime. There we are. It's working. It's all working. Okay. Oh, no, not too much lights down, please. People go to sleep much too easily. I never do it. So what I thought I'd do, just for about 25 minutes, I thought I would try and tell you what I think are the main developmental problems for which we need help from physicists, or which may interest physicists. The biologists may totally disagree, and the physicists may totally disagree, but at least we'll start a discussion. Then our final session on Friday, we can come back and see whether this bears any relationship to what's happened during the week. But at least we can open the discussion. Now, I've been here for nearly 5 weeks enjoying this wonderful, wonderful place. And many of the talks we've had already is about what is a module. And one of the questions that are being asked, are there generic modules for gene networks? Or is it just that the connectedness that evolution found that works? I must say, I am not impressed with the concept of module. It seems to be a convenient sort of verbiage, a convenient word, sorry, for many people, but I've yet to be persuaded that there are generic modules of any specific kind, and this is, I think, a major issue for many of the people who mention that they work upon modules. And so I think this is a difficult question, and I hope that it is one that's going to see. And if we actually just start off, Eric Davidson's not here yet, but just can I remind you, just very briefly, for those of you who, I don't want to start talking about Eric, this is the sea urchin, and certain genes are turned on in its development. This is the gut there, there's the mouth and the anus. Certain genes are turned on, for example, in the gut here. And Eric's analysis shows a very complicated control region here. In other words, all this is involved in controlling just one single gene, that it comes on and off at the right place. Now, you may say that this control region here, the cis regulatory region, is in fact a module. It's a cis regulatory region, but to call it a module, I don't find it terribly helpful, but I'd be very grateful for your comments. Sorry, this is the simplified version. There's the G that in this region, well, this one shuts it off in certain regions, this shuts it off in other regions, this is the one that makes sure that it comes on there. In other words, it's a very complex, and I would argue that what development is about is cis regulatory regions. It's the control regions. It's where and when the gene is turned on. And I'm not sure that there are any general principles whatsoever, but that's what you're going to tell me about. Now, it's just worth having a look at the Hox genes here. As you know, Hox genes are expressed along your body in the flood, and it's embarrassing to say it in front of people like Eric. Nevertheless, here are the Hox genes. And one of the real problems with Hox genes, and I think it is a major problem, is what their downstream targets are. So, just let's see what my next one is. just let me remind you, and let me embarrass the Drosophilus, including Eric. I can never tell. That's a leg. This is the antenna. That's an antenna, isn't it, Eric? Yeah. Well, I don't know. Which is the leg? I think, well, let's put...
He's coming down there.
Sorry? That's the leg.
No.
Eric, show
this
me.
This would be...
This is the antennapedia mutant, yes.
This is a leg.
No, this is a transformation.
It would be here. The antenna would be here.
But it's a leg.
It's actually a leg.
Thank you very much. Now, I was right. I was right. Here's the normal antenna of the fly. Thank you. There's the normal antenna of the fly. Here's a leg. But a single change in a single gene, antennapedia, has converted this antenna into a leg. And if you want to embarrass the Drosophila people, say, could you please tell me what the downstream targets are and how this happens? You will find, I do it with Antonio Garcia Bellido always, and the answer is they do not know. And of course it's possible to find out, but it really is a major problem. I would regard it as a major problem. So that's another problem where one needs help. Then, how do cells become different? And gradients and morphogens are quite fashionable these days. And this is the insect wing, and we have Telemann here who's going to talk about it. And one of the real problems is, so just here's the wing, and what happens is the cells here secrete a protein called decapentaplegic, and you get this nice gradient like the setup, and then at various thresholds, certain genes are set up. Now, what he's going to talk about, but the problem is this. How does one reliably and consistently set up that gradient? I simply don't know. Is it diffusion? Is it that it goes from cell to cell by little vesicles? How does it make sure that the gradient, this is at the right level, that these shapes are right, and how does it read it? Now, maybe you're going to tell us later today how it all works, but I must say it is really quite an important problem, and I'm not at all persuaded that it's been solved. Is it diffusion? Is it just how it's happening? I think it really is a central problem, also how it's interpreted. And how robust and precision is the reliability? And is there ever real redundancy? I'm going to come to your paper in a moment, Erica, on hedgehog. A real problem is, I know the director, just let me remind you, your limb is laid down when it's about that big. Then it grows for 16, 17 years. No connection between them whatsoever. It's pretty reliable that the two sides of your body, largely when they grow, have no connection. And on the whole, you're pretty symmetrical. And the more symmetrical you are, the more the women like you. And that's certainly true of animals. You know, how is that reliability achieved? With all the environmental and other genes things, it's a problem that we need to discuss. Incidentally, the word redundancy is forbidden in my presence, because I don't believe there is ever any real redundancy. You shouldn't confuse doing things two ways to ensure reliability as being redundant. And just remember, when you knock out a gene from a mouse, for example, and people say, oh, the mouse is perfectly normal. I say, have you taken the mouse to the opera? Can it still distinguish Mozart from Wagner? Unless you do the right phenotypic test, you can be totally confused as to how important a gene is. I can remind you that in yeast, one of the, there's a gene that ensures the animal or the cell will survive at pH 4.5. You know, you have to think about the phenotypic, what the role of the environment is. So just remember, you've got to take the mice to the opera. Don't tell me. Please.
When you say there's no real redundancy, you only mean it at the cellular level. Obviously, at the organism level, we have two kidneys and things of that sort.
That's not, well.
Which is a pure redundancy.
Certainly not. You can manage with one kidney, but do not as well. Oh, no. I'm no doctor. Who's the doctor in the house?
I would say half the audience could do with one kidney, the other half of the audience should be fighting for the other kidney.
There you are.
That's an age issue.
Oh, sure. No, I went. Sorry, I'm really talking.
At that level, you believe there's no redundancy. Okay.
Okay. Well, you may say my little fingers are little. No, I
went.
Yes, there we are. If it were truly redundant, you would lose it. That's what you're really saying. Yes. Okay. Good. Now, we have Eric Bischoff here, and he published a lovely paper with Liebler about reliability. There's a it's not quite another thing. Hunchback is too reliable. Just let me remind you that in the insect egg, there's a gradient. Sorry, I've lost the bottom of the slide here. I didn't mean to do that. Doesn't matter. There's a concentration of a gene called, of a protein called bicoid. And at a particular threshold, hunchback is set up. And there's a beautiful paper by Eric Vishaus here, which is saying that this thing is a bit variable. You know, this gradient here, which one's reading off the threshold, but the position of the boundary where hunchback is on and hunchback is off is remarkably reliable. And as I understand it, you haven't got a clue why.
I'm going to tell you how we don't have any clues.
Okay, you're going to tell her, but this question of precision and reliability is really a major problem, and physicists should be clever at this, but we'll see. Okay, and then there's the whole problem of polarity. Polarity is a major. I mean, there are very few processes in development, I think you'd agree, where polarity doesn't play a role. And this is just a slide I took from Peter Lawrence. It's the belly of the law of the adult. It's the adult fly, that isn't it? Yes, it's the ventral thing. And you can get, there are clever techniques for making clones of cells lacking a particular transcription factor. And this is where they've lost OMB. And I just want to show you. So these cells around here don't have OMB. This is the wild type. And you see, for peculiar reasons, some of these bristles now point in the opposite direction. Normally, the bristles all point in the same direction. You see that? Some of these now point in that direction, and then these, some of these point in that direction. And what the mechanism for this polarity is, which plays such an important role in many processes, or maybe Eric will help us with that too, but it is an important problem, polarity. And what's this? And then we come, and I'm nearly done. One of the things that this meeting lacks, and sorry, we're going to talk mainly about gene regulation, is morphogenesis. I just have to remind you that there are all sorts of forces in the embryo, mainly contraction, bringing about changes in shape in the embryo. And one of the key ones is something called convergent extension. A group of cells starts off like this, they take on shapes like this, then they intercalate. That's a convergence, and extend. So you go from this shape to this shape. I could give my own personal view about it, but I will desist. It's an important mechanical problem. It relates to gastrulation. It relates to why your body is elongated. It's something that Michelle and I work on in relation to the early chick embryo, to say that I claim maybe I understand it. Michelle is totally unpersuaded. Just to remind you about growth and compartments, we don't really know, and I'm going to have a little talk, Boris and I are going to have a little debate tomorrow afternoon briefly, as to what determines the size of the wing, for example. And for example, you can make clones. So for example, you can in this region here, this is a compartment boundary, just one or two cells have been made different from the other ones, and they grow much faster, and they eliminate the others. But they make the right size. Cells are not counting cell divisions. And how that size regulation is achieved is an important problem. It's also worth remembering that it's non-trivial that many embryos are Cartesian. And what I mean by that is they have the different axes at beautifully right angles to each other. The insect's a wonderful example. Anteroposterior and dorsoventral are totally at right angles to one another. How these axes are set up and that you get the right angles correctly is a non-trivial problem and needs to be thought about, particularly in the case of the epimen. Here, so you've got anterior, posterior, at right angles, dorsoventral, and then you also have left and right. We're not discussing left and right at this meeting, but it is an important problem, which I have some interest in. And just to remind you that we know quite a lot about the molecular basis. Once left and right are established, you get a whole cascade of things. But what the true, how you molecularly specify globally the difference between left and right is an important problem. And it's also related to how you specify this straight midline. How do you get that midline right? It's a non-trivial problem and it needs to be thought about. We have a model, incidentally, going back a long time, that the way you might do this is by having, for example, an F-shaped molecule. And as long as it's oriented with respect to anterior, posterior, and dorsoventral, you see already the left side is different to the right side because things are transported towards the midline on this side and away from it on that side. Whether it's true or not is another matter altogether. And then there's the whole question of positional identity. Cells do acquire identities. There's no question in the thing. But just to remind you that it's not just insects. This is a neutilum. You cut off the limb here mid-radius and ulna, and it will regenerate that. You cut it off in the humerus, it will regenerate that. There's very good evidence that in the neutilum, the cells down this axis have an identity, a molecular identity, so that you show this because when they regenerate, they don't make mistakes, very rarely make mistakes. The molecular basis of that identity and how it is encoded, because there's a lot of cells there, but they seem to know what they're doing. And just to show you, this is one from Jeremy Brooks, what is the molecular base of positional value? So when you cut off in the humerus, and there's a little blastema which will regenerate, you cut off in the hand there, if you put that on that, it intercalates the missing positional values. We don't understand it. And then, sorry, Eric, it's all about you. There's a nasty evolutionary problem. I find it very nasty. These are the pair rule genes, and each one of these, and I am right in saying they each have a different cis regulatory region. Each one is specified separately. Evolution is important. I have become something of a creationist. And why I say that, and why I say that provocatively, I find it enormously difficult to think about the intermediate adaptive forms. How could this have evolved? I have no problem in understanding the molecular, I have a problem, but we can see how it develops. But how did it evolve? And what was the adaptive value of the intermediate form? Even with insect wings, until you have a little something sticking out from your back, it's not terribly useful. And we all say that vertebrate limbs, evolved from little things that stuck out on our ancestral fish. But what use were they? And even with birds and feathers, until you can fly or glide, the thing's not terribly useful. I mean, Darwin was fully, was fully aware of this problem of intermediary form. I think it's a really, really nasty problem, which nobody gives a great deal of attention to.
Darwin's argument, how do you deal with this issue?
That it's difficult, but you have to keep, I can't remember how he dealt with it, just saying that you have to think, that if you, look, there was a story, how could the eye have evolved? And nobody could think, now we have a very good, nice scenario of how the eye could have evolved. It's just tough, and I find this particularly tough, and I think it's worth thinking about. I think that's almost my, yes, that's the end. So, there we are. So now having told you what I think the main problems are, the biologists and the physicists can tell me what I've left out. You agree? Don't be ridiculous, I can't believe it. Eric.
The thing is you probably personally rank them in terms of goodness, or maybe rank them in terms of interest.
Well, how would you, say the good fairy came to you, Eric, and said, I'll answer one question in a sentence about developmental biology. What would you ask? In fact, I think all scientists should know, for me, the good fairy is very important. Any decent scientist should know if the good fairy came along and said, look, I'll answer one question. I'm not going to give you a long explanation. It's a number or a yes, no, or a sentence. What would you ask?
The hard problem with the good fairy is that you have to choose whether you want the question, whether you ask the question which you have no idea what the answer is, or whether
I agree with you.
The question that you kind of think you haven't sorted out and you want to know whether you're on the right track.
It's a strategic. Okay, I'll give you two.
Okay.
Do you want to think about it? Now, you're not,
okay. I think the one that interests me most, in that there are reasonable models, but no molecular understanding, is size regulation. I think the way you compensate in some levels or other for size is something that we talk about a lot. We have some sense of how we even want to think about it, but we don't know really the mechanism. We certainly don't know in any demonstrated fashion how it actually works.
Well, that's one. That's nice.
And that's so that would be my not quite immediate solvable one, but it's the one that. Right, and then Darwin's intermediate forms is the one that's more difficult. Because I agree with you, I can't think of any good explanation other than that if you the world once existed under terribly relaxed circumstances where everything could continue to have, you know, with an extraordinary, I can't get that a model for intermediate forms to work intellectually.
Good, I'm glad, I'm very relieved to hear that.
And so there's those two, I mean, in the one hand, you've got a model that you kind of, you can almost imagine molecularly, and you want to know the next. Not the next, the big question, but it is still something you think you know something about, at least you think you know how to think about it. And then, I don't know how to think about the intermediate forms. I also don't really like the right-left asymmetry thing. I meant to say, I have a hard time thinking about what's coming up with a good model. There's no other way of thinking about it than models get little F's oriented themselves. But I dislike that. I don't like that.
I love it because it's ours.
But I don't. That's another one where I don't see. I don't have a. I don't feel comfortable. I don't have any way of thinking about it.
Well, we live in a three-dimensional world, and the cross product gives you the left-right symmetry. If we live in a four-dimensional world,
now hold on. sorry, say that. No, I'm lost.
If the fairy answers like that,
sorry,
would you be happy if the fairy answers?
No, I change fairies. But sorry, please.
Let me try to bridge a little and also say something. The cross product, of course, is you have two vectors that, if they point in a certain direction, they ought to, by mathematical convention, let's say, they specify one direction in a certain plane. Okay, so for instance, if you go one and two, then the third one is up rather than down. But the way that, this is a mathematical thing, how do you know which way the cross product goes? You use your fingers. Right? If you use your fingers on your right hand or your left hand, you're using a symmetry that biology has already set up.
You're right, but you cannot involve a handedness by selective breeding, even though you can selectively breed for a failure to maintain left-right symmetry. You can't involve, make the big part always on the left or always on the right.
But you can, that's exactly what's happened.
Even with your aorta or something.
Only about 1 in 10,000 people have the heart on the other side. Well, mutations apart, normally something goes wrong. And I have, it is special, and it's also just worth, I mean, the physicists will know that, well, I test the physicists out. If you had a conversation with someone on Mars, and you wanted to tell them what was left and what was right, and you couldn't send them a picture, could you do it? And the answer is you can't.
Oh, if you can agree on what's positive and
what's negative. No, that will not give it to you. No. Only one thing according to the... Exactly, beta decay. Beta decay.
The important question is that given chiral molecules,
yes,
and dominance of certain types of chiral molecules,
yes,
what's the mechanism?
Yeah.
Is that's most probably the more immediate question.
How you're quite right.
Okay,
well, I just think it is, I mean, handed, please.
About intermediate forms, the situation is not really that hopeless, I think. And if you look at the diversity of existing forms, there is a, I think it's Wallace Arthur, who did his work on this sort of worm, has a variable number of segments. So, you know, if you have a population with a varying number of segments, and you find one that works a bit better, at one length that works a bit better than the other, you select that one, and you end up with something like that.
Yeah, but that's easy with segments. You give me, I want the pair rule genes, please.
You work quite well with the eye, actually.
Sorry?
You have a very nice series of development.
Well, the eye, I said, the eye has been...
The eye is not exactly a simple structure.
No, I never said it was. But you're quite right, there is a story for the eye now. But I think wings and little things for thing of it. Please. Sorry? Well, tell me what the story is. How big are they? Remember, you see, the core of evolution, which I think most biologists here would accept, is gradualism. Yes, we're hopeful monsters are forbidden. We agree? All biologists say yes.
No.
Please. You think?
Well, I think occasionally, you know, you never know about the environment. The environment is so important. In the standard, you know, Darwinist argument is that of course you don't select for wings. You're selecting in a certain environment for some intermediate function.
Sure.
Like, you know, temperature regulation or something else.
Okay.
Gradually that, you know, then you go to another environment, something else is selected, and that may make it bigger in some cases, smaller in other cases. It's all a random walk.
I mean, I think it's jolly hard in many cases, and I want, since we know more about the insect than any, how that pair rule gene system could have evolved. And what was the adaptive significance?
Paul's going to tell us about it.
Because you can see that most mutations are actually neutral, and it's only several of them have occurred in combination that something is happening.
Cannot answer that, but maybe the geneticist can.
But, I mean, there's a story about the HSP 90 or something, story from a Nyquist, where people believe that there is a system.
Can everyone hear when you're talking, please?
A system which dampens the mutation which accumulates, and at some point, if there is a situation where you're in stress, but you need to evolve quickly, you just remove the dampening of the mutation, and then you get a random array of mutations that come together. And maybe in this case, it's closer to the hopeful monster, in the sense that it's not one mutation gets selected, it's like a bunch of mutations together, combinatorially can give rise to the structure. This is not fully accepted yet, but I think it's a very nice idea.
Sounds very creationist to me.
A way of relaxing your environment.
It is.
Effectively, you relax your internal environment, you tolerate greater diversity, and then at some point you select at the crucial moment.
Please.
Could you clarify why it couldn't happen that just one mutation made a large wing? I mean, why the need for intermediate small wings or whatever, just to give an example that I can use or that. Like, why is it clear that you just have one mutation?
Eric will answer. I think because the evidence, it's quite hard to see how that would happen. But Eric, I don't know what the biologists think.
In part, it's going from no wing to wing. Make a bigger or smaller wing, you can imagine that as an increment. But the wing.
You mean the complexity of the wing?
The complexity.
The number of parts.
So, what would be the intermediate thing? Is there a sensible sequence of intermediates before the wing that would let you think that you weren't making the wing from zero?
So the point you made is that something new happens where there's a very large number of genes that are involved in that. That's
the reason why you chose pair rule.
I did precisely that.
Because it's a very complex system.
Okay.
Didn't exist, and then suddenly it does exist, and it happens
simultaneously with a large number of genes in
it's a nightmare.
So for this examples where which you have pointed positive in what is the fossil record are there things that
can well you don't have fossil records for the embryo, you see. So you only have fossil records for the adult. That mod, you know, I'm not hot on that. But it doesn't tell you anything about the way they developed, you see.
So for the wing, you can, I mean,
please.
The wing evolved in the ocean somewhere. So on a crustacean, like some kind of...
Do you think the wing evolved there?
The system for, you know...
Appendages.
Dorsal flaps. And, you know, dividing the living field up into different parts so that, you know...
I never thought of that. I mean, there are marine insects that have dorsal flaps?
Crustaceans. You know, I mean, they have their wing.
I never thought of that.
They basically have, swimming appendages that are divided into dorsal parts and more ventral parts. Now, they're not completely dorsal, but they basically function, you know, both as gills and swimming appendages. So it's not clear that, you know, there wasn't already some previous, you know, selection for, you know, it might have been a breathing organ, it might have been some small flap that would give you some slight selective advantage in the ocean. So, I mean, that's one possible explanation.
Please.
Well, with regard to the parallel genes, it seems to me the hard part isn't so much the intermediate form as the interaction with constraints, because you see insects that make all of their segments in serial, you see the intermediate ones that make a few and the rest in serial. So you can imagine that if there is selective advantage for developing faster, and it's commonly accepted, although I don't know how well it's been checked, that parallel segmentation is always faster than serial segmentation, parallel computing, then you would definitely have selective pressure for doing more and more segments with parallel genes. The thing that I don't understand about parallel genes is why they should be hair-ruled. In other words, you want to make segments in parallel, why not have a gene that's expressed in every periodicity of three segments, but why not go straight from aperiodic things like gap genes to something like the Braille and Wheelis that makes the segments? And somehow there, maybe there's some constraint in terms of how sharp a border can be sensed by the genetic apparatus. So there's a case where you can, you know, with wings, I haven't thought of this dorsal flattening of the bottom before either. But, you know, there's some biophysical problem. And to the physicists, I mean, here's a really big problem. There is some idea of available pathways of evolvability that, to my knowledge, nobody really understands. It seems like insects can switch back and forth over evolutionary time between serial and parallel development of segments. But you never see, to my knowledge, an invertebrate evolving into a vertebrate.
No one's talked about modules. But we've had 3 weeks of modules, haven't we? Sorry, please.
Well, I have a comment. I'm actually, although people may get the opposite impression from my talk, I'm a true believer in modules.
Good.
But, if I had to ask the fairy a question,
yes.
I would ask the fairy, what are the true boundaries between modules?
Okay.
Because I think that present experimental techniques are not quite up to cutting them apart the right way.
So what do you see as a module? Just tell us briefly.
Well, a module is very operational, okay? If I used to want to be a physicist, and if I was talking to my friends who were physicists, I would say, well, you know, in physics, there's all kinds of things that are modules. Atoms are modules. Molecules can be modules. Little particles can be modules. If you heat things up really hot, from what I understand, all of these modules break down, including the modularity between different forces and stuff. So modules are very context dependent, and it's not like an absolute thing. The thing is, you need modules for humans to understand things. And so really, there's almost a design or engineering for theory aspect to modules. If you can't can't find modules at all, then understanding the system is probably completely hopeless. I think that, you know, there's enhancers, but, you know, are they always contiguous chunks of DNA? Maybe not.
But you think there are generic modules? I mean, one of the things that physicists seem to be looking for is that once you're going to have gene regulation, there are going to be some general principles. And my view is that, the question I ask is that evolution doesn't give a hoot about principles. It only cares whether it works. Please.
Is the program for the new limb during regeneration the same as during development?
Closely related, so far as we as far as we know, yes. Closely related, yes. That's not a module, though.
At least, I don't know, maybe you call a module a promoter region that is upstream of a gene, but I think there are more than modules which, like, signal, I mean, all the signaling pathways are modules which are reutilized many times throughout development, and the Hox genes are modules, and it's hard to make better as a module than that, which has been reused for many
Yeah, but they're very ad hoc modules.
No, they're not ad hoc.
Oh, sorry, please. No, that's it.
I think that signal pathways are very good modules in a sense, but I think, and there is a big question about the extent to which we currently see them as rather simple linear modules. Maybe this gets to the boundaries, but also actually clearly more of a complex network than signal pathways. And the extent to which that's a sort of meaningful network that does things, or that it's just something that sort of things do interconnect, but not in a very meaningful way, I think it's an important question.
Boris. Boris, please.
Maybe one workable definition is that it's the minimal unit that the selection can work on.
Did you hear that? I don't think you had a minimal unit that selection can work on. Selection only works on genes.
No, I think it justifies that once the system is working and there is a module which exists, it's so easy to reutilize it for many different purposes. And I think the question of boundaries is just to evolve, you just make branches to that module.
Because otherwise, why would you have the same two transduction pathways turning up in so many different contexts?
Because there's history.
What?
Evolution is lazy. Once it works, stick with it.
That's exactly what the module is.
No.
It's a laziness.
Would you call a gene a module?
You bet.
Yeah. Please.
So I want to challenge this idea that only genes and not networks could be the subject of natural selection. The typical complicated gene is in fact a module with a transmembrane part and a cytoplasmic part and so on. And I think it's fair to think of a gene made for exons or two different things as a network, as a module, which is parts that are co-evolved. And so I think in a strict molecular sense, networks could be said to evolve. And if that's true of the parts of a gene, then it could be true for small groups of genes that co-evolve.
Sorry, you don't want
to? You know, correctly doing some particular.
But the question is, are there generic? Could you from, sorry, now please, you want to say something, Boris? Sorry, it's the generic nature of, are there clever physicists who, looking at these problems, or biologists would say, if you're going to have that, I can tell you from first principles what sort of networks you're going to have. My guess is you can't. You agree? Okay. Please.
Maybe you should look at chemistry. There are generic structures in chemistry that make molecules up in cells, and those are used all over the place. So maybe it's similar.
Please.
I'm confused,
sir.
But there's an undercurrent in the discussion of modules, this generality, there's something about them that is generalizable. Is it that the module exists and its uses are generalizable because the module is always the same, but you put it in different places and it always does the same thing? So it's like a little module you could put in at different places in a complicated machine and it'll do the same thing. That's one of the ways of thinking about a module. And if that were true, then you could look at development, you could look for pieces that you put together and you reuse again and again. And that would be one idea of module. But
sure.
Each of those modules, but there seems to be another sense where there's something general or abstract about the nature of being a module.
I'm lost. Sorry, I don't know.
It was my first description of module, what everybody would buy into. And then is that an experimentally answerable question? find things that are used again and again in the same way in many different contexts in development, are we there to call those things, that is, care to call those things modules? And the problem there, of course, is at what level can we use genes in different times in development in different places? We use pathways that are comprised of many of those same genes, but not always the total set of those genes. So is the pathway the module? Is the gene the module? Is the bigger net? I mean, where is the, at what level of organization do you want to define your modules at?
Sure, absolutely. Please.
I want to agree with John Reiner, but extend what he said to say, you know, not only humans would be trust to understand biological mechanisms, but weren't modular. You could get our hands on small pieces of the study. It seems to me that it would be very difficult to evolve a genome in which changing one thing changed everything.
Sure.
And so modules may simply be necessary generically in order to subdivide too many high interactors into
the interesting. So it's to limit interactions, you're almost saying.
To be modified over
evolutionary time without screwing everything up. Right?
So, I mean, you know, you couldn't involve the universe really well if
you know,
there's a tweak,
times
constant,
or,
you know, the gravitational constant,
sorry, Eric,
you want to,
please.
It's really attractive about what you said, that one of the major pushes is to understand pathways in terms of networks and the interconnectedness of all of this. But in reality, what you're pointing to is this idea that they function, it may be better to isolate them, or to have some level of isolation, and we as scientists are certainly better in understanding the function. To treat them as isolated, it certainly has been historically better for us to treat the RIM signaling pathway separate from the EGF pathway, because they are, in fact, substantially separate in terms of their effects and how they work in organs. So and that does reflect maybe some fundamental property of that.
Please.
How do you build an argument? How do you evolve an argument?
Just to respond and amplify on what Eric said, I think it's sort of like what Eric said. There's sort of a notion of maybe you have one of my favorite terms of strong and weak modules. Okay, so strong modules, if you really extreme sense, say yes, there are these things, they are completely reusable in evolution, the same sense that objects in a piece of code are reusable. And then there's a much sort of deeper sense that in terms of analyzing a complex network, one early step you have to take is to look for any ways of separating it into understandable chunks and hope that this separation into chunks may in some way correspond to the underlying evolutionary dynamics. Although personally, I couldn't spell out any clues really as to how that.
Boris, did you want to make a comment on this?
Well, I guess going back to, the first answer is no, but but if you insist, going back to your search for intermediate forms, now there is a sense that half a module does not perform a function. So we're saying that half a ring doesn't fly.
Well, I think half a module may perform a function.
Half a signaling pathway doesn't signal. So we sort of have right there an idea of what the minimal module, like functional module.
I thought half a module could work.
Could do half the job.
Okay.
Can't
I don't. Okay. Anyone else want to comment, please?
I have a question. It's probably very naive.
Please, no. You're here to ask naive questions, and you'll get naive answers.
Is it possible to experimentally accelerate the evolutionary rate of some organism? That you could expose it to say a very selected environment, so you could see how that particular trait might move. So maybe you could irradiate a large number of mutants.
Well, that's been done. Sorry, that's precisely how the work on the fly was done, but they weren't doing evolution. Would anyone want to answer that question? I'm not sure what would tell you. In other words, you would irradiate and then you would select.
You would select bias the environment in such a way that there's a very strong selection for one trait. I'm not quite sure how this
works. What is it being done for dogs?
I was going to, exactly, you take the words out of my mouth. Look at dogs. How varied they are. But there are limits. Sorry, I don't want to tell you my evil, but just very quickly, Dobzhansky asked the question, if you had as much time as you like and as many people as you like, and you do just selection, no irradiation, but you've got as much, could you ever get people to evolve into angels with wings on their back? And the answer he pointed out, and I think he's absolutely right, you could get angelic disposition, because that varies, you'll never get wings. I have a feeling, please, no, you want to say something.
Well, in case physicists think that if we could answer all the puzzles you enumerated, we would understand development, I think we should add more things to the list.
Please. No, just add a few, please.
So this might be interesting to physicists. I would add the following
please.
Puzzle, is a deep puzzle to me. Many species that don't develop in warm, that aren't warm-blooded, develop at a rate that's dependent on the temperature of the oxygen tension for living. And when you change something like the temperature, all that happens is the movie runs faster or slower.
Really?
And to me, that's a deep mystery, because development is this interplay between diffusion and transcription and motors running up and down filaments and enzymatically promoted degradation and so on. And how it is that all these completely different processes,
very interesting. Thank you.
Keeps everything in perfect synchrony for most organisms.
So it's robustness again. Claude?
And this is over a factor of two, let's say, speed of development.
It's amazing. Thank you.
Specific temperature compensation, right? And I think it's why we have positive and negative regulation that comes together. And I think, for example, the clock that runs all the way to 24 hours, whichever temperature is, it's an amazing system, which is built in what you say, but it's basically the same principle. And I think the wave runs that way because they have positive and negative regulators, and those are both affected by temperature the same way. And so basically they compensate. But I think it's, I mean, to some extent, there are ways to go around
it. Yeah, there are ways. I mean, you can think of some ways, but it seems to be a very general feature. But so there must be some very fundamental scheme to keep everything in sync.
But again, I think the fact every positive regulator, every signaling pathway, you secret the growth factor, and immediately you secrete the anti-growth factor to compensate for that. And that was, it doesn't make sense a priori to do that, except maybe for this kind of short
term. Sure, but I mean, that's one particular process, but what about this famous Turing mechanism, which is a balance between how fast diffusion spreads something out and how fast degradation erases it?
No, but we have no Turing mechanisms in development, I claim.
Yeah.
Well, no, we can argue. Sorry, Boris, I think we're going to... Okay. Thank you very much indeed. That's a good beginning. Well, I'm glad, you know, we can see some
I
of the...
Think, right, in the rest of the meeting, we'll get to the nitty-gritty, and then we can
very good.
Come back to philosophy.
So we start here again at 11 with Eric Richards' talk. Thank you.